If you like weird history, true crime, haunted and paranormal, then pause the podcast you're listening to right now and subscribe to Ghost Town wherever you listen to podcasts. We also have a video component to our favorite Ghost Town episodes at youtube.com/Jason Horton. Episodes like The Los Feliz Murder House, The Toxic Lady, The Black Dahlia, Janis Joplin's Hotel Room, The Haunted Roosevelt Hotel, and more. Just go to youtube.com/Jason Horton. That's youtube.com/JasonHorton. And while you're there, please subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. Thank you. It's Friends Without Benefits. It's the Friends Without Benefits podcast. My name is Jason Horton. Welcome to the show. Today, my guest is Matthew Glaive. You may know him from such movies as The Wedding Singer. He played Glenn Gulia, who I think is one of my favorite, villains? I don't know if it's even a villain, but one of my favorite characters. I love The Wedding Singer. I don't love every Adam Sandler movie, but The Wedding Singer is just one of my favorite comedies. It's really great. He's in Rockstar. He's in Narcos. He neglected to mention that he was in First Man with Ryan Gosling. I'm like, why wouldn't you open with that? That's how, if I find a dollar in my pocket, that's how I open a conversation. I was like, how am I doing? I found a dollar in my pocket, so I'm doing pretty well. But Matt is such a low-key, chill, humble guy, and not like a fake humble where he's like, I don't want to talk about it. He just really is. He's just like a down. I'd be the opposite. I would be. I'd be talking about it all the time if I had actually people to talk about it with. So I guess how would I know? Matt was in a movie called Funny Story that I'm in for a hot second. But he's also in the movie The Thinning, and now The Thinning: New World Order is out on YouTube. It's not YouTube, but YouTube Unlimited, YouTube Premium, that you can get, I think, the first month or 3 months for free, or I don't know how it works, but it is a YouTube original. Then it'll be on, I think, VOD sometime in the future. I am also in that, so you might want to check that out. And I'm in the trailer for a second. You can maybe go check out my Instagram, TheJasonHorton, if you want to see that trailer. But yeah. Matt is in that. I am in that. I'm friends Michael and Steve and Jana and another Michael, make and produce these movies. And they are kind enough to put me in them. Basically, because I'm like, you know what? It's more annoying to not put me in them than to put me in them. So that's how I get work. You know, that's how I do it. But Matt is great. And if you've watched a television or a movie, you've seen him. And he's a super cool guy. And I was really excited because I was always kind of a big fan of his. And then to meet him and work with him, it's cool. It's surreal for me. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm very easily starstruck and impressed. And he's a cool guy. And towards the end, like, he really kind of gives me if it's not motivational speech, but yeah, he gives me a little, I don't know if it's a pep talk. I don't know. I guess maybe, kind of there's some subtext of me looking for, a little pep talk, and he gave it to me, and you can hear that at the end. When you're listening to this, if you're listening to this when it's out, I will be either in Prague or Copenhagen. I'm not sure. Started in Berlin, then I think it's Copenhagen, then it is Prague, but that's where I am. If you want to see pictures of what I'm doing, I don't know if you're one of those people that like to see that stuff, or is it annoying? I promise I won't post like 5 in a row on Instagram, but the Jason Horton, and then I'll be blogging about it on my travel blog, which is ghosttowntravels.com, which is kind of part of the umbrella of the Ghost Town podcast, which you should be also checking out. Why not? Do it. Something else you should do is Care Of. What is Care Of? Great question. Care Of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. I've been taking vitamins my whole life. I think my father really instilled that in me when I was young, and I've just always taken vitamins. Sometimes I'm like, it's a little willy-nilly, but I'll tell you something, Care Of has kind of reignited my passion for vitamins, and they've done it in a way where I'm taking what I need. They have a fun online quiz that asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices, and it takes only 5 minutes to find out what vitamins and supplements you specifically need. I thought the test was super fun. I was just like, I'll take more of these tests to find out what I need and what I'm looking to achieve and how Care Of can provide that. Because 90% of people fall short of FDA-recommended guidelines for at least one vitamin or nutrient. If you take Care Of's quiz and get the vitamins you need to get back on track and reach your health goals, the vitamins get delivered directly to your door. I mean, I talk about this all. It's like, I don't want to go to a store and then people ask me a bunch of questions. What are you looking to do, man? What's going on? And that's their job. That's totally fine. But you know what? I want the information and then just deliver it to my door, pretty much how I do everything else. Any excuse not to leave the house is good for me. There's Honesty First. They provide all the research that supports each of their recommendations, backed by a scientific advisory board. A portion of every sale goes toward the Good Plus Foundation, which provides expectant mothers in need with valuable prenatal vitamins. Come on. Right? You're helping yourself, helping somebody else other than yourself. You can track your progress with the Care Of app and earn rewards when you remember to take your vitamins. Remember to take your vitamins. That's like part of my DNA, is remembered to take vitamins. Your monthly subscription box can easily be modified at any time. There's vegan and vegetarian supplement options available to match your dietary needs. They have delicious nutrient-packed quick stick powders, which I'm very excited about, that can be added to your monthly delivery for an extra easy boost whenever you need it. It's great. I just took the quiz, which was super fun. Whereas sometimes I'm like, I don't want to take a quiz. I don't want to do a questionnaire. But this, I was just like, this is really, really, it's intuitive, and it's really interesting, and it's informative. And they hooked it up. They hooked it up, packed it up, sent it to me. Really excited. Even more exciting, for 25% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter FWB in the code. Go to takecareof.com. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, and enter FWB in the code. Takecareof.com, enter FWB in the code for 25% off your first month. All right, let's get to my conversation with Matthew Glaive. You know, we've hung out a couple of times, business-wise.
We wrestled.
We wrestled. Thumb, full-bodied wrestle.
Everything. Yeah. Everything.
Shirts and skins. Skins versus skins. Which you were like, how about we just do skins versus skins? I was like, how are we going to know whose team's on what?
It's
like,
just skin.
It's just skin. But I remember when you first started working with Michael Gallagher on the Thinning One. and I was like, oh my. Like, I was like, please tell me Matt is a nice guy. That's all I wanted.
Really? Like, you needed to know that?
It was important, yeah. Because, I mean, like, I don't know how people are. I was like, please tell me he's a cool guy, because I like that dude. And I was like, I want to. And Mike was like, he's great. Loves wrestling. Like, just loves wrestling. Strictly guys.
Yep.
Just loves wrestling. And I was like, okay, that's not what I wanted to know, but right. Why that was the most important thing. And then we met on the, was it the Funny Story?
I guess I never saw you on the Thinning, because we weren't anywhere around each
no,
other.
No, I wasn't. But... I wasn't in the Thinning One.
Oh, you were in. It was Thinning Two.
It was Thinning Two.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I wasn't a,
because I only
being...
watched the rough cut of Thinning Two, and I put them together. That's right. That's right.
All the Thinnings run together.
It's a blur.
But it was a Funny Story. Filming Funny Story.
Yes. Where,
yeah.
Yes.
We met, and. You know, Funny Stories is a movie that I don't know if you're familiar with it, Matt. It's a movie that
you're
in.
Well, Funny Story.
Yeah, Funny Story.
I actually had something to do with it.
It had something
well.
To do with it.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that's going around the festival circuit. I got cut out at most of the parts that I was in because I'm not a human being. Fine. No big deal. But I feel like that. Is your family like, hey, are you ever coming home? Because it seems like you're always at a festival.
No, this is this has been really fun following it around.
Yeah.
At the festivals.
Well, you're always at pretty nice places.
And they've been, they've been, it's been really fun seeing how different people organize festivals in their town and get everybody going.
Do you have a favorite one? I mean, I don't want you to play
favorites. No, I don't. I don't because it's every time I go to one, I was like, well, this one, everybody's goes out of their way. It isn't even just the place and the people that run the festival. I'm getting to meet these other filmmakers, and then I go and I see their film, and then I'm starstruck that, like, this guy's sitting there watching his film. Yeah. And there, I was like, I had no idea. Because that's what all these films are like. I wouldn't have thought of that. Or you're always impressed that, like Michael Gallagher did with Funny Story, I'm impressed with the amount that somebody does with so little in such a short time. Yeah. And film festivals are just people that love film, and then they talk film, and conversations go deep into the night because it's what you want. It's really an exciting experience. I don't have one more than I love than another. Yeah. There are some that stand out, but they've been different kinds of festivals. There's been a wine and film festival. There's been the one I came back from was about 30 miles from where I grew up, was born in Saginaw, Michigan, in Bay City, Michigan, called Hell's Half Mile. And that was like a rock bands and film festival, totally different. You know, the closing night is in a warehouse with bands playing, which isn't the same.
It's a little more rock and roll.
Which isn't the same as Sonoma, where we're just doing wine tastings after. It's just totally different energy, but same thing.
How did Jana like that? Because I think she's more of like, but she can rock and roll.
Jana didn't go. Jana had to work.
Yeah, it's convenient. She was at the wine one though.
She was at the wine one.
It made sense. So you're from Michigan. We were just talking.
I'm from Saginaw, Michigan. Yeah.
When you went back there, you're like, ooh, look at Mr. Hollywood.
Mm-mm.
No.
No, I moved away when I was really young, so I didn't have a lot of friends that were adults. It was mostly friends of my mom's and older family members that remembered me when I was really little, kind of a thing.
And where'd you go from Michigan? Where was your next?
Ohio. Okay. We moved to Ohio.
You're in a relatively similar part of the country, but it's
similar part of the country, Michigan, where I grew up, was just outside of anything urban. It was cornfields and sugar beets, and Cleveland was not like that. Much more urban, and the sprawl stayed more urban than it was.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to Cleveland once, and I didn't get to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But
Cleveland's very pretty.
Yeah.
It's really, really pretty.
And when did you go from there to Los Angeles?
There's excitement going on.
There's
TED Talk is very
successful.
Yeah,
that TED Talk. I told you they wanted that TED Talk, and they're not going to stop till they get it.
No, I graduated high school, and then I moved to Louisiana, and I worked in the oil fields, oil rigs for a little while. I didn't really know what I was going to do, and then
I should have guessed that. That's a cool story.
But that was a big thing in the 80s. In the 80s, the Midwest was a little bit depressed, and there was all this oil field promising work in Louisiana and Texas. So my brother and I moved down there, and it didn't take long for me to realize that was an extremely hard – they work very hard down there. And then after I lived there for a while and did that, I came back to Ohio, and then I went to college in Ohio, and then I moved to Chicago. Then New York, then here.
At what point were you like, I want to, you know, the arts is something that I'm interested in a serious way?
Well, I wanted to do it when I was a little boy. I was a big film head. We had a great movie theater down around the corner, Court Street Theater, and my brother and I would go to every time the movies changed. We would go every weekend or every other weekend or whenever movies were switching out. We'd see a new movie, and I just lived in films, and I didn't know that I wanted to be a film actor. I just loved movies, and I wanted something to do with that. But there was nothing going on in Saginaw that I could be part of with that. And so I didn't really get into it until I was like 19. I followed my brother down to college at Ohio University, and he introduced me. He was part of the punk rock music crowd because he was a fine art painter and furniture designer. And so he had the whole cool punk rock art, music, and theater crowd that he hung out with. And he goes, talk to young Jane Young. This beautiful girl named Jane Young who was in the theater department. She's like, come see me in a play. So I went and I saw her in a play, and she was great. And it was a Shakespeare play. And I was like, wow, you can do that. How do you...
That's a thing.
I mean, it's like when you have no concept.
Sure. Same here.
And I don't know, how did you start? Because when you first get up in front of someone, didn't you at any point worry that it was vain? Like, this is so vain, thinking that I should get up and I should stand in front of everybody.
Yeah, how dare I, you know?
I mean,
yeah.
That's what I thought.
Sure, yeah.
And I had to see someone else do it and be good at it to go like, oh, it's kind of more than just all about me. But it seemed really vain idea. How was that for you when you started doing it?
I mean, I did a little high school theater, and then, you know, I got into like video in like the mid-90s a little bit. And then not until I moved to San Diego in 2004 did I start doing improv. I'm like a late bloomer when it comes to a lot of stuff. But the benefit, I think, to me is I was like probably like 29 or 30. I knew myself really well then. So I feel like I could kind of express myself and kind of roll with the punches without worrying, like, do I look cool? Is my ego going to stay intact? So I think even though I was a kind of a late bloomer, I had that going for me, I think. But I did have that. I was like, I always thought somebody that I was just like when I would watch you in movies and stuff like that, it would be like, it's for me to watch and it's for you to be in. And that's the divide. And those paths shall not cross. And I wasn't saying it in a way like somebody's better than me. I was like, that's just the way it works. You know, somebody's got to watch and somebody's got to do. And it was just for me to watch. And then moving in California.
Until, interestingly enough, you give yourself permission. You
just exactly.
Like, it's a funny thing to give yourself permission to go ahead and do something and not judge yourself for going ahead and doing it. It's an interesting turn. Because I felt like that was a huge turn when I suddenly started actually walking onto a stage, and it's a weird feeling. Someone's like, okay, your turn, get up and stand in front of people and be interesting with whatever you're going to do.
And the people just sit there and take it.
And then that bizarre feeling of judgment where you're standing there and there's people sitting below you in chairs just looking. And if you stop to really realize how horrifying that is, then you're done, or you have an idea that you want to go with, and then it's exciting.
It's like a rock band.
And it is exciting. Yeah. It is exciting, particularly if you feel like you have a good idea. It's just really nothing. All it is storytelling anyways, whether it's an improv or you want to have a fun story and everyone wants to follow that story. And it's as old as time. All we ever want to do is sit around the fire and hear a good story.
Right.
And
I mean, it's like right now we're doing a podcast, and sometimes I wonder like why people, like, I listen to podcasts like when I'm commuting or I'm working out or whatever it is, I'm going for a walk, and then, you know, but I always thought, I was like, well, no one's going to want to hear what I have to say, but here we are.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought of this because I listened to a couple of your podcasts before we start, and then I listened to a couple other podcasts, and it's maybe because I'm not younger. I'm not old, but I'm not younger. Yeah. I'm not as hip to the podcast scene, although I've been listening to more and more podcasts. It's kind of like, I don't know how long podcasts have really been going. It's some years, you know. But the thing to me about a podcast is it's like, it's novel in a way that refrigerators were in the 20s. Like, someone's like, we can keep up the food for days now. And it's like everything's revolutionary because a podcast is like a great conversation format that goes everywhere. And you're not limited to a time frame where you have to get it all in before the sponsor cut. I mean, you can actually have a conversation and talk about something that you care about, and it's less gotta get this in, gotta get it in under the wire, and you feel like on a TV interview where somebody's moving along, we gotta move this along, you gotta plug the thing, you gotta say when it is, where it is, and you feel this, and I gotta be what, witty? I gotta pop it in under the wire and everything, and I mean, it must be exciting for you, this format.
You know, it's one thing is interesting in what I've been, the criticisms that I've had is sometimes it's too short. Where I think I'm like, oh, I'm taking up too much real estate here with like whatever it is. And people are like, no, it should be, if anything, a little bit longer because, for you know, if people have an hour commute, I mean, I've commuted. I mean, I'm sure you've driven across town more than once and you're sitting there and some, you know, listening to music's great, but sometimes I want to get lost in a conversation about something about science or something I didn't know about, or like hearing someone's life story. I didn't need to know anything about them previous. And all of a sudden I'm like really invested in this like human being's journey for whatever that is. I mean, it's a great, I mean, I got a pretty, I've done a couple, I've got a relatively early start, in it, but it's a pretty, pretty new thing. I think you're here at the right time. You know, I think you're, right in it right now.
And how did you come to doing the podcast? Like, how did you realize like, this is what I'll do while I'm also doing this and I'm doing that?
I think years of doing, improv comedy and being able to switch gears, not needing to like do a ton of, you know, I'm not the best, like I don't do a ton of research on something or a person because I do another podcast called Ghost Town and it's about haunted, abandoned.
Which place. We could do because yeah. I've had haunted experiences.
Well then, yeah.
Several serious ones.
Okay, well, that's.
Where yeah. I went to college is one of the top 10 yeah. haunted places in the United States.
Yeah, I'm going to want to know more about that. Like right now, Friends Without Benefits, just currently while we're saying this, is number 6 on the iTunes comedy podcast, and it's number 57 overall all podcasts on iTunes right now. And Ghost Town is number 15 and like number 200. So it's right now is a great time. It's a now's a good time for me. But I think I like I've done things where I've interviewed people and I've done roundtables because I am able to switch gears and I don't need a ton of preparation or I don't need to be front load things with a lot. So it just – and I just always like to know – I find other people more interesting than myself and I'd rather hear more from somebody else than I would to talk about myself.
But I feel the same way.
That's so we're at an impasse here.
That, no, it's not an impasse. It's just – it's the funny thing yeah. because it's more like it's fun to talk about interesting things yeah. than to talk about ourselves, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
people we've met that are interesting or places we've been that were interesting.
And celebrate you know, other
– And just everything that's interesting in life.
Yeah.
Right?
What would you say – so would you say Ohio was when you first started really like rocking and rolling with the acting thing?
Yeah. The first acting job I had was we had to rob a bank for the local bank. We each got paid $60. The police department wanted – like 3 or 4 people from the theater department to come after hours to the bank with a, you know, sort of a, what's the right word I'm looking for? It's like not premeditated, but it's a prepped
okay, yeah,
bank
yeah.
robbery.
Yeah.
The tellers know we're
Simulated,
about to come
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
Tellers are there. It's after hours. We're going to come in and rob the bank. And they have to do the protocols that they're supposed to be, that they're trained to do. And then we leave. And then the police department comes in and asks them questions about who did what. And it was really fun, actually, to come.
That sounds so. I would do that for free. I mean, I would take the $60.
I did it twice.
Yeah,
it was really fun.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I would take $60 now for it. Never mind.
But
I felt
like a successful actor because I, you know, I robbed a bank for $60. And that was my first.
Yeah,
my first paid acting job.
Yeah, and not your last, which is good because then
yeah.
we have more to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was it like? So from there, like, what was your next move?
I was just in theater. Yeah. I loved theater. I was a film guy.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. Like, in the Midwest, you want to go into film somehow. It didn't. Yeah. I wasn't around anybody that was in that arena.
So your avenue was
theater. My avenue was theater because yeah. my brother knew the people in his department. Then I met these great people that were part of this whole nother world. And then I managed to, on a fluke, get into the theater program without auditioning to get in. It was kind of a fluke. So what happened was I was in freshman year was just freshman year, but sophomore year was in the theater program. But I was in the program with a bunch of people that had been together since freshman year, and I'm jumping in as a new student sophomore year, having never auditioned or done anything. So it was very strange to be in theater classes with people that had been doing high school theater and they'd had the whole year before. They'd been in some plays, and I'd never done anything. So
they were like lifers at that point.
They were lifers at that point,
yeah.
And I was just sort of jumping in and getting to know them, and it was horrifying. Theater people are terrifying, but you know the super extroverted. Pick me, I'll jump up, I'll do it.
Yeah,
you know? And I was a very horrifying experience, but I survived them.
And then what was Chicago? Because you know, Chicago is a you know big theater, like especially improv comedy. Comedy in Chicago is like huge too, with the you know
yeah.
Second City and IO Chicago and all that. What were you doing in Chicago? Like what was it?
I just moved to Chicago.
Yeah, because it's close.
Well,
part of it, or?
Well, I was in a theater company in North Carolina right out of college, and then when I left college to go to that, and then when I was done, I was like, where am I going to live? So I went up to New York, and I left my car in Brooklyn, and I flew to L.A., and then I came back to New York, and then I drove to Chicago. I just wanted to see what all three cities were like.
Yeah.
Then I settled on Chicago first, like a Midwestern boy.
Yeah. You know? Was New York and L.A., like, were they just – they weren't, like, grabbing you at that point?
I didn't have a concept of Los Angeles yeah. when I got out here. I was like
– Do you now? a little bit?
I'm just beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
It's like – all I remembered when I first came out was walls.
Yeah.
Like big, huge walls. Like, oh, that's a studio.
Yeah.
And then, like, but there's just giant walls that you can't. How are you getting on that one? I had no idea. It didn't seem like a place to begin.
Yeah.
for me. And then I came back and I was in New York for a couple of days, and that just seemed enormous. And then I just went to Chicago for not long. I didn't live in Chicago for long, which I really like Chicago a lot.
That's right. I've only been there twice, but it's a great really city.
Great place.
And then I'm just kind of following your path.
So then after Chicago, I went I lived in Chicago for a little more than a half a year, and then I went back to the theater company in North Carolina, and then from there I moved to New York. Okay. So I lived in New York for about 3 years.
And I just want to go back a little bit. Like, so when did your brother stick around with doing the oil?
My brother and I, no, yeah. Well, my brother was, he's 2 years older than me, and we always were kind of inseparable, or we'd follow each other around. And he actually was going to move to Chicago knowing I lived there. And by the time he got there, I'd already moved away. So then he stayed in Chicago for a very long time. But he stayed in, he first went down when I was, that's a bit of a, blur. I think I was out of high school. He was living in Houston, Texas, and he was working for Western Geophysical, and they wanted to pay for him to go to geology school and do all this stuff. And then he was going to come back and do that. And he did a complete, like, right turn and went straight into fine art because he was a great painter. And so he just painted, and he got into the arts. And then he transferred from Cleveland State down to Ohio, and down to Ohio University. And then I followed him down. So I got into the arts because of my brother. He kind of paved that path. And so he's kind of responsible for anything in that arena.
I mean, so I figure being in New York, I mean, and coming from something from like a little of the alternative-ish kind of punk art scene, New York seemed like a pretty good place to be for you at that time. I don't know. It seems like it makes sense.
Yeah, my brother didn't live in New York when I went there. Yeah. He moved to Chicago as I was moving to New York.
Yeah.
So then he'd visit me in New York.
Yeah.
But probably most of the fun and interesting aspects of I don't feel that I'm very interesting now, but I had interesting things happen then, which everyone does when they're young and running around.
Yeah.
I had a couple of interesting, exciting things. I don't even know which ones to tell you.
We'll put it up on the paywall. So we'll put it on that big, people can pay the premium to hear your like juicy stories.
Oh, the paywall.
Yeah, right. That paywall goes up. And if you want to hear like your, the real uncensored stuff, they can get that later.
Okay.
That's, business. You know what I mean?
That's the extra, like, just to hear more.
Yeah.
Put in your little sound of coins, and then all of a sudden you get like 30 seconds.
We're teasing them right now with, North Carolina Theater.
Because nothing's more provocative.
Well, we're wetting their whistle, you know what I mean? Like, they're, it's very
tell
provocative.
Tell us some of those dangerous Charlotte stories.
Yeah. So what was New York? I mean, were you...
New York was great. I lived in Spanish Harlem with my good friend Scott Sowers. And it was... We were the roses of Spanish Harlem. We lived in, like, the fourth floor. And it was very rough.
Was that
116th and 3rd?
Okay, yeah.
116th and 3rd. That was pretty rough.
Yeah.
And one morning, I woke up, and we had one of those railroad apartments,
goes from walk all the
front
way
to the back, right? Just room, doors, from the back of the building to the front of the building. My bedroom was all the way in the back. And I woke up, and I woke up to hearing my drawers being opened and closed, and I looked up, and there was somebody opening and closing my desk drawers and going through some things on the desk. And I was looking at him, and I thought, is that the gas man? Because in Michigan, if there was a stranger in your house, he would bang the back door and he'd go, gas man. And he'd come in, and he'd go down, and he'd read the meter in the basement. And it was kind of a different setup.
Yeah.
So my first thought was, is this the gas man? And he was wearing a really dingy, plasticky tracksuit, and he was really skinny, and he was going through stuff, and I just was laying in bed looking at him, and then he looks at me, and I go, I'm just looking at him, and we're just kind of looking, like, and I'm like, suddenly you get this Marlon Perkins in the wild, like the gazelle and at the creek with the alligator, and he looks at me, and he steps forward, and he goes, gonna kill you. And I go, he's gonna kill me. And I can't catch up, the brain isn't really catching up. And he steps forward again, and he goes, gonna kill you. And I go, he's gonna kill me. And he reaches behind his back, and I go, and he goes, give me everything. And I go, gonna kill you, give me everything. And like that's the pause of the brain going like trying to figure it out. And he goes, oh, he's robbing me. It's money. Oh,
okay.
And I was like, oh, and I reached down and my pants were by the side of the bed and I reached down and I grabbed my wallet out of my pants. And I had just kind of moved to New York and I had just gone downtown and got a New York driver's license. And I went through that whole awful DMV thing. And I thought, if I give him my wallet, I'll lose my license. And I'm not going to give him my wallet. And all this is going through the brain. And I opened up my wallet and I had three 20s in it. And I thought, I have no money and he can't have the whole wallet. So I took two 20s out. Like, I'll just hold
back. You negotiated with him.
I negotiated with myself. He didn't even see.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at it. And I reached in and I pulled two 20s out. And then I handed them to him. And he reached forward and he grabs my hand. Oh, he had reached behind himself to pull something. But in my brain, I'm thinking, if he had a weapon, he would produce it because it would make this all go very quick, you know. But I mean, it's funny what the brain is bouncing so many things when you're just behind the eight ball. And so he grabs my wrist and his grip is so very weak. It's just like, it's like a child grabbed me. And I'm thinking, and he was so skinny. And I was thinking I feel like I could pick him up and then and break him in two pieces.
Yeah.
But I'm lying in bed in my underwear, you know, in a funny position. And it's also behind.
Sure, yeah.
And then he grabs the money and he runs out of the room. And what he'd done was he'd come in through the bathroom window and he went out and he had unlocked all the locks on the front door. So it was an interest. He'd set up his escape before coming in. But the startling thing was that the bathroom we had was, it was a 24-inch window. So it was two 12-inch squares, right? And if you open it, you've now got a 12-inch square bottom that's open. It was about 25 feet to the bottom roof of the building to get to our thing. He'd stacked tar cans into a staircase.
He earned that money.
And crawled all the way up. But even more, he got through a 12-inch by 12-inch square. He got his head and his hips through a square like this. And you're right. You're right. That's a lot of work, and it does deserve $40. There was this huge muddy footprint on the sink. And I remember thinking, like, it was so funny. It was... It's a weird thing when you're victimized and you feel violated. You're running around trying to get it back. So, and he just took my money and he didn't take anything else. But the police, I called the police and the police came and they're walking around and I had this dagger on my desk because I was doing fight direction and I staged fights in theater and I've been doing that. I love doing that. And there's this theatrical Shakespeare dagger sitting on the desk and the cop goes, "What is this?" And I go, "Oh, that's just a Shakespeare dagger for theater." And he goes, "Next time, stick it through his fucking heart. Save us a trip."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Well, that's some good advice, officer.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me to kill him.
Yeah.
Next time and save you the paperwork."
And New York City I remember New York City going there as a kid. I remember New York City maybe as early as like the late 70s up until, you know, the early 2000s-ish. Eventually I moved, that's around when I moved to California. But I remember being on the subway, you know, the Guardian Angels were there.
They were there.
Yeah, Guardian Angels. I mean, I was young, but I remember like the graffiti and the peep houses and, you know, how Times Square was and stuff like that. So that's where I remember that.
Times Square is just, it's hard to believe Times Square was Times Square. You have to go watch Taxi Driver.
Right,
with Robert De Niro gritty, to see old Times Square.
Yeah, Scorsese movies or something like that to kind of catch up on that. Did that sour you on New York?
No, it was within my first couple of months of living there. So it was like I pre-disastered it. I got it out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, oh, well, we got that out of the way. Now, you know.
And you're like, eventually I'll mention this on podcast.
It did make me a little loopy.
Yeah.
I had a little boombox and I had some personal items. I thought if we're broken into again, you know, in my logic, I thought if I spray paint everything a little bit of a color, then I'll see it on the street and I'll be able to go get it back.
Yeah.
And so I spray painted everything.
Like a LoJack.
I spray painted my personal items on the back and on the top green. And so I still have a boombox in my garage that has faded green spray paint on it. It's like a dual cassette boombox, you know. But
for all your bootlegging.
Well, it's just a funny thing because you're, you know, I knew when I moved there and I met all these New Yorkers, I understood this sort of great survival thing of New Yorkers, where they have a personal space automatic defense mechanism. Like, you don't really get handsy with a New Yorker, you know what I mean? You don't kind of grab them their arm. They're like, don't touch. It's an instinctual, automatic, this is my space, we're all trying to get by. You don't touch me, we're okay. And I totally respect it. I was from the Midwest, though. I was completely taken by the overt nature of the...
And there's so many people moving in so many different directions, so close, but they manage to keep this kind of like unspoken distance between each other in a way when you're like walking around or...
Yeah, and there's this... because I want to say something that I think is smart, but it's not important to make it my idea. There's a guy named Jordan Peterson, who's this clinical psychologist, and he was talking about the miracle of New York and how it's a miracle that people aren't killing each other everywhere in New York. Like, that's the miracle isn't, you know, it's not strange that that violence erupts. It's a miracle that it doesn't all the time.
Yeah.
People have all made a pact to be civilized and get through all this madness of on and off of trains and all the, it's just amazing.
It's just a lot of people in a small, you know, occupying a small amount of real estate, essentially. Yeah. And then, so from, at what point, in New York, so you were doing was it a lot of theater?
Yeah, I was really just getting started with that, trying to figure it out. I had a roommate, James Victor Mack. I haven't seen him in a long time, but I didn't have an agent, and my two roommates were like guys who graduated their college with agents, and I didn't know anything about that world. And I remember James had an audition for Hamlet, but it wasn't for the role of Hamlet. It was for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And he's like, I don't want to go to this audition. I really don't want to go to it. And I said, how about I go for you? I'll just go for you. And he goes, yeah, you can go if you want. Now, it was a black production of Hamlet, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were both black, and my roommate James was black. So I was like, I'm just going to go as you. So I went to the audition, and they were like, okay, James, and they called, and I go, here, and she was looking at this headshot, and I said, James can't be here. I'm auditioning for him. And that was like, I think my first audition in New York was for someone else that had an agent.
Yeah.
And his agent called him back, and she was livid. She was like, you send somebody else for your audition? And he goes, I couldn't go. I was sick. And he made this thing up. And she goes, and she was really mad at him for sending somebody else. And she was even madder because she had to tell me I had a callback, which I thought was really funny. I didn't get it, but I thought that was humorous.
Yeah, it's like a very...
My first audition was for someone else. I was like, I'll just stunt do it for you. And if you get a callback, you can go. But he didn't want to go.
You're like
he
a proxy.
Do it. Yeah. Yeah, New York is a great place to be young, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I think I had a lot more time being young in New York than I did being young in Los Angeles when I first moved here. It just felt like you could stand on somebody's rooftop until dawn in New York and talk and feel like it was far more exciting in those beginning times. I don't know how it was for you.
I guess you need friends, right? Is that?
Do you need friends?
Do you need friends for that? Because that's
well, no, because I'm imagining you standing on a rooftop in New York alone, talking to yourself dawn. You're like, this is the nicest conversation I've had.
So good.
You are such a good listener.
Yeah, I got so much out of this.
You're we should do this again.
Yeah,
like, we can because we live here.
Yeah, we're.
And we'll
it's always a yes.
Yes, always a yes.
And was from New York? Was it like okay, LA's next on my?
I landed this good agent.
Based on what, though? Like, what makes you, I'm just, you know, what makes you land a good agent?
How did that work? I had a friend. It was literally just because through connections of being out and talking and meeting and being available and meeting somebody, somebody needed, I was friends with somebody that had a manager and the manager needed a new person to answer phones. And I was like, I'll see what that's like. I did it for 2 days and she said, you're terrible at answering phones for a manager. But then she represented me for a short while and introduced me to a couple of agents, and that's how I met my first agent there. And then, but the agency was bi-coastal, and then the head of the agency came to New York and said, come to Los Angeles, and there's more going on here.
And where did you, I just said, you know, for kind of geography, where did you first shack up in Los Angeles? What part of LA?
Right in Hollywood. Right in the heart of Hollywood, like east of Highland, just before Western.
Okay.
I slept on somebody's couch until his landlady had another opening in another apartment, and then I got that behind the Shakey's Pizza off Sunset.
Okay.
That's what I remember.
Yeah.
Yes.
That classic. You're like, one day, you know, if it all falls through, I got Shakey's Pizza to work at.
I got the Shakey's Pizza right on the corner, and I came here in 91.
And what was the landscape of like hustling and getting work back then? Like, was it?
It's really interesting how drastically everything has changed. Like, I think in the early 90s was just in terms of communication, right? In the early 90s,
it's like answering services.
In New York, I remember I had an answering service that was just people. You would call and say, "Any messages for box 309 or something?" And they would be service. And you'll say box, and I go, and I would, in New York, I'd go, "Hi, this is Matt Glavik. Do you have any messages for 309? And then they would give me my messages, and I'd call in and go, "Hi, this is Matt." He goes, "You don't have to say your name. Just say the number." I was like, all right, man. And I'd call in after that and be like, "309? And he'd be like, "Okay." And I was like, "Hurry up, get on with it." But it was weird. It was human answering service, if you remember that.
They knew how to answer phones, though, I guess, right?
But then by 91, 92, we got the pager thing. So now everyone's just got a pager on their hip, and everyone's wandering around having their hips buzz. Then they got to run to a payphone to say, "Well, who's calling?" And then you're like, "Oh, I got an appointment." And then you got to figure out how to get your sides. And back in the day, some people at hoity-toity places had them delivered to them, and other places you had to go get them. We had a box at our agency, and you'd drive to the box. You'd open it up. You'd go through the envelopes, find yours, and get your information. And then
there's something exciting about
it. It was like a messenger
that.
Service
yeah,
about
something
it.
Something very exciting about
it. Your life was
that.
A messenger service, and you were doing it on the fly because sometimes it was the same day. So you run out, grab the box, open it up, you know what it is, and you're driving to it, learning it. But it's just, it's changed so much because, you know, I didn't have a pager, but I would know that I had to find a phone booth to call and say I was going to be late for an appointment or something. And now there are no phones. Like, it's slowly we've lost phones on the landscape.
Yeah.
It was so funny that they used to be everywhere and now no phones.
Yeah.
Kids are grown. My kids, I don't think they know about phone booths except from old movies. Like, you wouldn't see a phone on the street. There are no phones.
And if you see one now, usually the phone is for some reason cut or something, graffitied or something like that. What would you say your first like big break? Beside the thinning.
Oh, well, the thinning really pushed it over the edge.
Yeah, that was that's next level.
That really was the next
big,
level
big thing. Yeah.
I still have people saying, aren't you the governor in the thinning?
Yeah.
You know. I've had politicians call me and ask about governance.
Yeah, like how
you were so the governor
in the
I don't thinning. Even know how you did that.
Yeah.
It was so governy-like.
Yeah, it was so apocalyptic and dystopian of you.
But like the leadership of your governorhood.
Yeah.
The people just can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, The Wedding Singer was huge. But
I had done
a couple of things. I had to go on tape for a movie that Dennis Hopper directed, and I knew when I went into the casting director that like he was going to see it, and that was so exciting to know that I'm going to do this thing, and then he's going to watch that, and I got that job, and then I met, and honestly, my first real part in a movie was his movie that he directed. It's called Chasers, and it wasn't the greatest movie, and he actually would show that film when people did honorarium. They did like a thing for him, and they're like, "There's going to be one of Dennis Hopper's films screened, and then there's going to be a talk back with him afterwards." And everyone's thinking they're going to show Easy Rider or something like that. And he shows this movie called Chasers, and he says, "I wanted you just to see this movie because I wanted to see how a movie doesn't work when you have an argument with the studio." And it was about showing them what he wanted to do and what actually was done. And I thought it was kind of brilliant because he chose something that, by his account, was a failure. But he wanted to talk about filmmaking, so that was why. And guy was brilliant. So it was very exciting. I honestly, my first time actually working was with him as a director.
That's not a bad pedigree.
No. And his directing style was like infection. He infected you with how to do something, whereas other people are trying to like tell you what they want or something. He would just come up and he'd be like, he would just kind of get really close and he'd be like, "Listen, man, in this scene, you're looking at her and you're like, I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
I mean, look at her. right? I mean, you're like, and he's like leaning forward, and I go, I got it. He'd give you a feeling rather than
surface,
really super visceral communication, and it just felt, it was really exciting. That was the hugest. Is hugest the right? It's the hugest.
The hugest, yeah.
Thing,
yeah.
That I could think of for me.
But you mentioned the Wedding Singer as being, was that like your first kind of big exposure type?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's the hugest is.
Obviously thinning. Hugest is.
You know what I mean? That's,
but thinning's that's, it. But yeah. But yeah, that was really great. That was really great.
And, yeah,
and it was an awesome experience. I mean, as you can see, the movie is fun. It's fun to watch. It was fun to do. It just looks like fun. It looks like everybody's, because Adam has a massive, his best friends are around him at all times. Yeah. And so imagine you always have your own best, closest, reliable people creatively, yeah, supportively.
Without getting too comfortable.
They're totally comfortable because they're like brothers.
Yeah.
He's just, it's family with him. And that's what he carries with him as he moves through always, is this good, solid family. And it has that feeling when you're doing stuff with him. Always creative. You know, it's weird because it's like a quick memory from a long time ago, you know, doing that. And yet I remember it clearly as fun and not nervous or nothing. We were just like, every day was, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
And I love hearing creative. That. I mean, because it's
no, he's, know. He was the best. And anyone that, I'm sure anyone that's talked about him has always said that because, you know.
I think that's his, one of my favorite movies with him, probably because I think it, the fact that it's so funny and it's so, it looks good and crisp. It's like a crisp, good looking movie that has a lot of elements that, I don't know, it has all the things I like. And I don't know, there was just like, I'm not like the biggest Adam Sandler fan. I like him. I think he's like a really good. I think he's a good dramatic actor. Things that I've seen him in, like, you know, Funny People, and even him in that, I thought was like a pretty like. It's like a little tiny bit of darkness in this bright neon movie to me, I guess.
Yeah, I like him so much in that movie because he is our romantic hero, and he doesn't necessarily. He's funny. But he doesn't take the majority of the funny. He gives it to people like Steve Buscemi. And I mean, he gives outrageousness to other people. And he's funny in it, but he's our romantic hero. And that's overrides. And so the thing I liked the most about the movie, about what they did, was she chooses him over me, not because I'm a douchebag. She knows nothing of it.
You're right.
Only he knows that this guy is going to see other women and do all this stuff. She just makes the decision on her own. It's obvious I'm the wrong guy, but it's really a good romantic comedy, and he's our leading man, romantic guy, and he does it really well. So,
but I mean, you know, I think you can make an argument that, you know what I mean, maybe she made the wrong choice.
She did. It's obvious
she made the wrong choice, and I think it would have maybe gone a different, you know, different direction, and it would have been really. Listen, you had the money, you had the car, you had the clothes. And what have I learned? That's the most important thing. Important thing.
Like love?
What is that? It's intangible. There's no dollar
Besides,
sign.
It's just going to wear off.
Oh my God, right? It always does.
You know, it's like the Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really believe that, like, in about 6 months, he's going to come across Florence and he's going to be like, oh, Juliet who?
Yeah.
He just kicks this other girl to the curb at the beginning of the play. Like, you think he's going to hang with Juliet if they don't die? No.
I was mentioning my brother, I was going to have you on the podcast. He's like, make sure to talk about Rockstar. Like, that's his, like, you and Rockstar.
That's a fun movie.
It's a fun, and you, like, the character you play, again, it's like, these are the, I like that kind of, like, alpha square. I mean, would that be fair to say you're, like, kind of an alpha, like a, you played a
cop. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
But you're a square because there's all these rockers. But then you also are supportive, too. So you're not like a bad guy. But you know what I mean? Like, you're a company man.
Yeah. That was fun. That was a funny movie. That had some funny.
That's the thing. Like, Mark Wahlberg is not, like, I don't. There's some things he's in that I really like, and there's some things he's in that I don't like, I guess. But that was one thing that I thought was, like, really well done.
Oh, he did a great job.
Yeah,
You know, and then the shooting the concert scenes are, like, that was a huge, I think we did that at the Forum. I might be wrong, but, like, the big concerts that he did, those were those were awesome, and they were shot, and the people that were in the band were like Zach Wilde,
yeah,
and Jason Bonham,
yeah,
and good. I mean, he had like these solid rockers bringing up the whole flanks of it all. It yeah, was, it was great,
authentic. There's like an authenticness
yeah.
to it.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where like, and then I'll like you're. In like I saw you in Narcos, and I've just seen you in like so many different things. But none of them are The Thinning, though.
Almost, I think no. honestly, aside from The Wedding Singer, and I don't really know that The Wedding Singer is up there.
No,
but Thinning, then it's just a funny thing.
It's that YouTube like a red original thing that really kind of like changes the
like
game.
A rocket.
It's like. Next level.
Is Michael going to think that we're being?
I do this all the time. Listen,
you're doing this because he cut you out of a movie.
You know what? It's a coincidence. How about we just say it's? Listen, I got a platform. He's got
listen,
a platform.
Your stuff was good in the last movie, and it was one of the things that I'm not going to go off on a long tangent on the funny story scene.
Yeah.
But what was amazing about that movie to me was what an amazing job they did, because they trimmed away so much good stuff.
Yeah.
They did. They trimmed away all the good stuff, of which yours was good stuff. I loved the stuff you did in the beginning, which we're going to talk about something that no one knows.
Yeah.
But what you did in the beginning where you're introducing people and doing talking to people, all great.
Yeah, that was fun.
But it was really great. But it's funny because in the context of that story, he had the wherewithal to trim and keep something to the point of whatever that point was.
Not essential to the plot.
And it's hard because I had stuff cut as well. Yeah. But I understand that... There's so many things involved. Yeah, it's such a big, massive ball of to make a film, to cut a film, to know what to keep, what to lose, maybe take this and put it over there. What he did with that movie, he did such a great job, and they trimmed it down. It doesn't have a long running time, but it's because it was like, we get it. That tells the story there. Keep moving.
When I saw the first, I saw like a rough cut, and we did like a notes session on it. And then when I saw the one at the screening at the Arclight, I was like, this is so much funnier the second time, or, you know, whatever I saw. Like, the humor was so good and so subtle, even though it's not like, you know, like a – it's a dark – whatever you want to call it, dramatic dark comedy or, you know. And I thought everyone was so good in it, and it made me – because, I've been working with a lot of the people in the movie for a long time and the YouTube world and various other stuff. And, you know, sometimes I only see them as them doing their thing. When I watch this, I was like – I'm seeing a bunch of really good actors working together, and I told Michael this, so I let my walls down. You know what I mean?
Those women are, you know, they were everyone was so kick ass.
Yeah,
those women were kick ass in it. They were all exactly who they were. Very natural, right?
Yeah.
It didn't nothing felt like here's where something's funny. Yeah. Something just happened to be funny. You called it what? A dark comedy. I called it a sad movie that's funny.
Yeah, okay.
It's really to me, it's just a sad movie.
It is. Yeah.
It's very even. Throughout the movie, it's just when you really think of it from a perspective of family and relationships, it's just a sad movie.
Yeah.
But it's a funny, sad movie that because of the way that it's written and put together, it is immediately sad, followed by really big funny, followed by really sad.
Yeah.
Like within 12 seconds,
and
a turn is very huge and then back to sad again.
Some nice awkwardness, which I can always...
Always appreciate.
I can always appreciate. But everyone was so good, and like Jana was so great. I mean, she was so great, and like Nikki and... Steve, everyone was just so good making that movie. And
Michael.
Michael
was in it.
Yeah. I mean, I could have done that part.
He actually was the standout.
Yeah, I probably could. I mean, it's really the story about a guy who introduces karaoke.
It really is.
That's the
story. It's a funny story.
But yeah.
That's what it's really about.
That's what it's really about. So hopefully it'll spin off. It's a Hitchcockian thing he did.
He has been changing like every time there's a festival, there's a different sort of clip that he just uses a still, and sometimes it's me holding a suitcase, and sometimes it's Emily, you know, pondering something. You know, I think what ultimately when it's distributed, it's going to be him holding the microphone, introducing the karaoke. So funny story that will probably be the final poster
we'll all remember. Yeah.
But
we, you know, I think this will. I'm purposely timing this one to be right after the Thinning New World Order comes out.
Oh.
So, you know, as I'm talking about this, it's not out yet, but it'll be out so quickly. I won't say when, but when you hear this, the Thinning New World Order will be out, right? Is that the word? Or
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
I don't know. I mean, I know that there's, in fact, I think there was like a premiere thing that I don't know the exact date. But so you want me to
look at this Hollywood guy.
Know?
This guy's Hollywooding me.
What do you mean?
This guy's giving me the Hollywood. He's like, I got to be in Encino.
I got a thing with my daughter.
Three. Family. Okay, well, we got to.
No, I'm joking.
Okay. family comes eighth. Just
he did. Know. He did send me something, but I mean, it's probably the. Oh, I can't say any hard dates, right?
Because no, we can. This will be after that hard date. That's why I'm purposefully talking about it.
Oh,
I'm releasing this after the hard date.
In my brain, I have the 17th of October.
Yes, so
17th of October.
The 17th of October.
Because I invited my daughters to go with me.
The Thinning New World Order will be out. When you're listening to this, it's out now on YouTube Premium or wherever else it's out. I'm in it. I heard I'm in the trailer. I'm in the trailer. I heard I'm in the cutting room floor of the trailer, and I'm emptying the garbages in the actual trailers to clean up after you guys as a job. That's what I heard that I'm doing. But I heard I'm in the trailer. I'm actually going to see Michael on Tuesday, and I was like, I want to see this trailer. He won't send it to me because I think he's afraid I'm going to like post it somewhere.
He's
being sensible. He's a sensible guy. But I'm excited about this. You know, I made the cut of the thing. I'm actually in this one.
I haven't seen. I saw the roughest first rough.
I saw a very rough cut. No, you know, there's no graphics or whatever. I think it's going to be – I'm excited to see it, but it's out. Check it out.
Breakout role for the governor. Breakout.
Yeah. I mean, the governor is back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is it. I mean, part three is going to be
– Oh, it's going to be just off the hook.
You know what I mean? It's going to be more dystopian than ever.
Yeah. The Thinning Three is probably just going to be called Governor Redding. I might be giving something away, but it may just be called Redding.
Yeah. Well, I remember I actually auditioned for it, even though I knew him. I had to actually put myself on tape because YouTube had to approve or whatever. And I actually read the script. And
Read the script.
I actually read the script like a real actor. That I don't consider myself one. I just consider.
Why don't you consider yourself? An
I don't
actor?
Know. I have this thing
when
where
in hell.
And I audition for things, and you know, occasionally I book things. I don't know. I still kind of, I'm just very middle class about everything. Like this Fiji bottled water.
Right.
Like I feel like you deserve that Fiji bottled water
more than you.
Yes.
So you have to put yours in your own canister.
No, this is a 5 month old or 6 month old Brita filter water. From my house. I don't even deserve new Brita filter, is what I'm saying.
So it's up to you, though, is what
it's
you're
really,
saying.
It's really
it's
up to me.
It's up to you to give yourself zero permission to do anything.
Yeah, so that's what I'm learning right now.
Yeah.
I mean, you survived. I mean, you had a Shakespearean dagger story and survived it, so maybe I'm learning a little something from that.
Well, no, it's such a funny thing because it's like, I think it's kind of madness to go and go into a room full of strangers and pretend to be someone else. In fact, I have this great friend of mine who keeps me, he doesn't give me any breaks. Like somebody could say like, oh, that was really good. And people could say like, oh, we're so happy that you did. And people can fill you and put, you know, fill you up and give you accolades and things like this. And then he'll call me and call me a loser and tell me all these things. And he left me a message this morning telling me, he goes, what are you? Are you probably busy? Are you busy like memorizing your role? So you're gonna go. Are you busy getting ready to go act like someone else in front of strangers? And it sounds so stupid the way he says it. Like,
yeah, it's pretty
you're
accurate,
gonna go
though.
Into a room and you're gonna act like you're somebody else in front of people you don't know, and it is pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Stop and do that, it's gonna be the worst thing ever because suddenly you're like, I'm not a baker from New York.
Yeah.
Doing this scene, you know, and then you suddenly have to. You get like self-conscious that you're an idiot standing in front of strangers, pretending that you're sad because your daughter's ill.
I have an existential crisis about the whole thing. Like, what does it all matter?
Doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
Which is why it's fun to do that.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, a little kid, you just say, okay, you're this. And the kid just does it. There's no stakes.
No judgment.
They don't care.
Yeah.
And then when they're done, they leave. And then all they want is ice cream. They don't even care about what you thought. Yeah. What a great setup.
Yeah.
It's the whole neurosis thing that, like, would you consider yourself neurotic?
I absolutely would, yeah.
And what do you think about that? Do we have time? Can I ask
you?
Yeah,
no.
Because I'm curious about it as well.
Here's the thing. It's a thing where I'm kind of accepting it, where I'm like, I do have neurosis and I'm like kind of living. It's not a thing where I'm trying, like, let me pretend I'm not that. Like, let me pretend that I don't have this. And I kind of embrace it. And, you know, and I've been doing a lot of stand up comedy lately. It's going really, I'm performing in, I'll be back from Berlin, but I'm performing in Berlin.
Excellent.
And doing some stand up out there.
And a lot of famous German stand up.
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm going to be huge out there.
Have you seen any self effacing Germans in your life, much less German stand ups?
Yeah, no.
Not a lot.
No, so I'm hoping it goes well.
It will go well.
It will go
well. Laugh at you.
Yeah. And not with me.
Not
at
themselves.
Me. No,
not
yeah.
themselves.
Yeah.
Right. Very so serious Germans.
I kind of just really I embrace it and I kind of accept it and I just work with it instead of like trying to like push it back, you know?
It's interesting. It's interesting because to me, neurosis is, and I don't mean this negatively to you because I think it pertains to myself as well. I find that neurosis is a rather narcissistic thing, and it's very self-absorbed because I feel the same thing. But because what happens is the voices, if you have the voices, they're like, who do you think you are? You think you can do this? You think you're better than so-and-so? Do you think that you have any right? And you're sitting here, it's self-inflicted. So these little arrows are shooting at you, and it's all self-inflicted. While you're making your way to the stage, you're going, and you're all self, instead of, not who gives a shit about me. Here's this idea. It has nothing to do with me. Just want to get this idea out. And then you start talking. And the next thing you know, you're interested in subject matter that isn't your neurosis. Yeah. And because it's immobilizing. I've been immobilized by it. So, to the point where, you're terrified. But what is it other than being preoccupied with yourself? Because you're preoccupied with your own failure or success, judgment of others, judgment of yourself. And then you're stuck with you at the end of the night. So it's all about you being stuck with you, or they're stuck with you. And it's an interest to me. It's interesting because after a while you're like, I gotta find the other way that isn't about me, because who gives a shit about me?
Yeah,
it's about a good idea. If we start talking about a movie we both like, we can go for another hour and a half talking about something we're excited by, and they'd be interested that we're excited because we're interested.
We're sharing.
Has nothing to do with whether you're good enough or funny enough or anything. And it's really an interesting thing. And so many performers are immobilized by that.
Yeah.
Or you walk off afterwards and you get in your car and you start going like, oh, I did this. I said that, and the timing was a little slow.
Yeah.
And you start going.
The other people in the room at the audition, I was like, oh, that guy was hotter, or that guy was more nerdy looking
why did
than
he,
me.
Why did that? And then you're thinking about, like, oh, I was in the room, and this one guy was, like, looking at his phone. He wasn't even listening while I was talking. And you start micro-analyzing all the behaviors of other people, and the next thing you know, you're carrying, like, this globe of crap back to the car. And it's fascinating, because it's all bullshit.
Back to my Jaguar.
That's what I'm saying. But I mean, but it's so funny that it's also completely unimportant.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to those times that you felt you had a good idea, you put a good idea out there and you discussed it, and then you were like, nah, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Let's call it a day and go do something else.
Yeah.
Do you feel that? Because I'm sure you've had those boosts where all of a sudden you feel like you're on fire and you're like, if I could feel like this all the time, what was that? Thing that made that happen.
So,
do you know what I'm talking about?
I've had it, and I've been in it, and it's felt good. And then I also feel like, sometimes I can't even enjoy the ups because I know it can't stay up, and I'm already thinking about the down before I hit the down.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's like what you get then is this extremely short time period where you feel good.
Yeah.
Before something else comes in and goes like, okay, well, don't expect that to last. Don't think that one's gonna, which is really kind of, it's just a funny thing that it's so self-defeating. Like who told you that you didn't deserve to be doing that?
Nobody.
Like who's the one?
Me. I mean, I mean.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated because you're like, there's gotta be times when you're like, fuck it. I don't care.
Even when I don't do well, they always at the end of audition, they're always like, great. You know, nobody ever says, listen, this is not for you. Please leave. It's always like, great. You know, I'm not, it's like, it can't be right for everything, or I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be working constantly or be famous constantly or whatever the case may be.
And that's the thing. Being famous is nothing to pursue.
Yeah.
Being skilled at anything is something to pursue.
Sure.
That's exciting. And it's exciting when you go out and you go out. I've only done stand-up once, but I understand the I respect it so highly because I consider it the most vulnerable thing. Whereas some stand-ups feel like they're more in control being able to do stand-up than they are being able to do the scripted word because they feel self-conscious about somebody else's words. But I give a massive amount of self-credit and credit to others is that we're doing this, that you would get up and put yourself through that because you think you have something to say, but you're not alone. If you go look over there, there's a whole bunch of guys and ladies that do it. They do the same thing, and they're the ones that get out on the front line. They think they have an idea. They want to get up and express it, and so you're comforted in that other body of people that want to get up and try. Because basically what happens is a lot of people come up to you in life that see a movie or saw you do stand-up, I'm sure, and they're enamored that you're doing it. You know what I mean? They're just – because they are vicariously saying, God, I wish I could do that. You know, I had a 15-year-old kid. I did a play years ago, and a kid waited in the back of the theater for me, and his aunt took him to the play, and she brought him twice because he wanted to be a comedian, and it was a comic play. And I just remembered that was like the most exciting thing because some kid was excited because he would like to know how to get up and be in front of other people and be funny. And it was like, it wasn't me that he loved. It was the excitement that I'm doing it. And it felt, and I invited him for another performance to sit backstage and watch the play from the wings, which was really exciting for him, you know?
And he went on to be Barack Obama.
It was Barack Obama. Which was weird that he was so much younger than me, but now we're the same age.
It's weird. It's like Hollywood, government, kind of.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
But I just think it's exciting because it's like, that's what's amazing is that you actually do it. And you do it again. You get up and you go do it again. Yeah. And a lot of people don't and can't. And I don't know. I'm going to drink this Fiji because I got better water than you.
Awesome. That's great. That's good. I'll do a hard stop here. That's it. That's it.
Oh, that was horrible.